Hello, and welcome to the Business Decisions Podcast. My name is Stuart Wood, and I'm the CEO of Caravel Law. Every week, we bring you stories and insights from founders, owners, and leaders of great businesses, followed by some thoughts and input from one of Caravel's lawyers. Caravel Law has been a leader in legal innovation in Canada since 2004 and has helped many startups and small businesses overcome challenges as they have scaled and succeeded. Our hope is that these discussions will help existing business leaders and inspire others to start their own ventures. Now, let's get to today's guest. Today on the podcast, we'll be joined by Jeff Hawker. Jeff is the president of Hazemag in North America. During my conversation with Jeff, we talked mostly about his decision to sell his company to the parent company for Hazemag in Germany and what it's like to transition from being an owner to being part of a management team. Following my conversation with Jeff Hawker, we'll be joined by another Jeff, Jeff Clam, who is a corporate lawyer at Caravel Law, who does a lot of M&A work for us. So now here's my conversation with Jeff Hawker. All right. Today on the podcast, I'm delighted to have Jeff Hawker. Jeff Hawker is the president of Hazemag Canada and Hazemag USA. He has a master's of robotics from McGill University in Montreal and worked for 4+ years at McKinsey & Company before joining Hazemag in 2005. Has been running the company for the last 15 years. So Jeff, tell us a little bit about Hazemag.
Sure thing, Stuart. Thanks for having me on your podcast. This is a lot of fun. So Hazemag is a company that is involved in the minerals processing industry. We design, manufacture, and sell equipment for minerals processing and what we call comminution. We are involved in the mining space, minerals processing space, the aggregate space, and a host of other industries.
And so when you introduce yourself to people, do you say, I crush rocks for a living?
That is the simplest way of describing us. Yes, I tend to say minerals processing first.
Oh, really? That's less fun. And so you've been running the company for about 15 years now?
That's right.
And so how has the company changed over the last 15 years?
Well, the last 15 years have seen a lot of changes in the industry itself. It's become a much more multinational space. So we've gone from smaller domestic players to larger companies across international borders. So that's been a big change for us. And also, there's become an increased involvement of engineering firms getting sort of between the end user and equipment solutions providers like us. So those are the industry changes. Of course, for Hazemag North America, the biggest change for us was 5 years ago when we were reacquired by our German parent company. Prior to that, we operated as an independent licensee owned by me and my family.
And so who are your customers?
So in North America, our biggest customers would be aggregate quarries, places like Lafarge, in the United States, Vulcan, Martin Marietta, Rogers Group, CMEX. Those would be our biggest customers. But globally, we are involved in the mining space with companies like Rio Tinto, BHP, many different large companies. And then, of course, there's a whole host of smaller, both mining and quarrying companies.
And Hazemag is known as a industry leader, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. We invented the impact crusher back in the 1940s. And so we're known predominantly for that technology, but then we've been around for a long time. And so we have developed a host of other products and solutions. And so we really are involved in the entire minerals processing space.
And so, as part of your role as president of Hazemag North America, do you go out and visit these mine sites?
Yes, I do. I go and visit customers whenever I can. It's not always easy to, but it's one of the highlights of my job.
So what sort of places have you been?
Across North America, I've really been sort of to all of the major areas where there's big aggregate quarries and certain mines, potash sites, really North America-wide. I'm responsible for Mexico as well, so I've been around Mexico quite a bit to see different installations there. But I have had opportunities to travel in Germany and Estonia and South Africa and many other places to see interesting mine sites and aggregate operations.
You mentioned that 5 years ago, the parent company in Germany acquired Hazemag North America.
That's right.
So what's the relationship been like with the parent company?
Well, prior to the acquisition, we were a licensee of Hazemag. So we had access to their technology, the drawings, we had the right to manufacture. But more than that, we always did operate very closely with our friends and colleagues in Germany. So we though we were an independent business, we did have a special relationship. Since the acquisition, that original set of relationships is a good foundation, and it's expanded. And so now we are sharing much more information, but better yet, we're really able to get the individual areas of expertise around the world that are part of Hazemag can be brought and deployed to all the other different geographies. And that's been sort of a real highlight for me over the last 5 years, and it's been one of the big motivations for what the strategy was for why we did the acquisition.
What are some of the examples of connections with other parts of the world that you've been able to apply in Canada and the United States?
Well, so the minerals processing space is highly dependent on the particular minerals that you are actually processing. Mm-hmm. For us in North America, we developed a real strength in aggregate quarries. And really, it's what we call blast rock. So that's where you blow up a big hole in the ground and you take that rock and you process it. There are lots of other forms of aggregate. There's things like river gravel or alluvial deposits, but that uses a different type of technology. And so prior to the acquisition, we hadn't been as involved in that space. Since the acquisition, this is just one example, we now have access to other technologies that have been proven very successful in other parts of the world, and we can now deploy them in those other areas. We've also been able to get more exposure to industries like iron ore, more exposure to diamonds mining, and a whole host of other slag and other recycling capabilities.
And so would you say you've put your mechanical engineering education to good use with this company?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm not the lead designer in our company, but what we do is mechanical engineering. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that background really is a requirement to be able to manage our team of engineers, work with our vendors, and help drive the innovations and the problem solving that we do for our customers.
And you spent 4+ years at McKinsey & Company, is that right?
That's right.
And how do you feel like that experience has helped you in running Hazemag?
Well, I mean, that was really the other side to it. It was critical. In fact, I do think that much of my success in this role has been because of that experience. I mean, look, when you're a management consultant with McKinsey, you get to see many different industries, deal with many different types of people, learn a whole host of management tools. It requires an incredible amount of self-reflection. So you certainly learn about yourself a lot, about what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are, which has proven to be very helpful to know in eliminating those blind spots to help you become an effective manager.
And how big is your team here in North America?
We're about 22 people here in North America.
And after the acquisition, have you stayed in the same role as president of the company?
Yes.
And how has your role changed?
Prior to the acquisition, we were focused more narrowly in the aggregate space and some select mining applications. Since the acquisition, we've had access to a much broader set of technologies and capabilities, and we've been able to draw on the expertise of our global partners. So there's three different segments of the business that I've now have the opportunity to develop and grow, which are in addition to what our core business had been. And so that's been really exciting for me.
And are there any downsides to now becoming an employee of the parent company as opposed to the owner of the North American company?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you do get used to not having a boss, and that was a transition for me. But fortunately, I do like my leadership team in Germany, and frankly, the leaders of the other divisions across globally. So they're great. So that's been a transition. And then, of course, when you do have a shareholder, when you didn't before, there is more reporting and accountability that's required. So that's not always fun. But I have used it as an opportunity to make sure that we are using that reporting to make sure that we've understand our business as well as possible. So I try to make sure that when we are asked to do a report or to provide information, that we build it into our processes in such a way that it's not just about fulfilling a reporting requirement, it's about making sure we're learning something from that report that we can use on our own. It's not always easy to do that, but when you can, it helps.
And so I know that for a lot of founders and business owners, the decision to sell is a very difficult one. So I'm curious to know, how did you go through the process of deciding to sell the company back to the parent company?
So that's true. It's not always an easy thing to consider. I mean, the company had been a part of my life for really almost as long as I can remember. But I did understand clearly what the parent company was trying to achieve. They had gone to market over the last 7 years by having licensees around the world. And more recently, it was clear that they were trying to recapture control of all of those different geographies in order to pursue a growth agenda and a brand building agenda. And being able to see that that was what the end game was gave me a lot more confidence in going forward with it. So I don't know that we would have sold it to just anybody, but they were the right buyer with a strategy that I understood and believed in. It made sense to me because I could see that their reacquisition of the licensees did allow for a global brand development that would unlock value that was not as easy to achieve.
And did the timing line up with what you had in mind?
No, I mean, I didn't have a timeline in mind, right? They approached me and we were able to have a very honest and good discussion about, you know, what the plan was, what the goals were. And then we took our time. It took a long time to sort the terms of the deal out. But all of that, I think, was very beneficial because by the time we all put our signatures down, we all knew exactly what we were getting into. And I think that it made the day one of the new structure feel very comfortable.
And were you able to continue to run the business without the concern from the distraction of the potential acquisition? You mentioned it took a long time.
Yeah. Well, I'm very lucky that I have a very solid, strong team. And so the time that I was taken away from what my day-to-day activities were, yes, they probably suffered, but my team was very strong and they were able to help out that way. But yeah, no, that's a legitimate question and concern. Fortunately, we were able to get through it.
And was there an emotional component to it? You mentioned the company had been in your life for quite a while. Was there some complex emotions involved in deciding to sell?
Yes, but not as great as I think for someone who was the founder of a company that hadn't existed before. So we were always the licensee of an existing brand. So whenever we did develop the brand, it was always in conjunction with the parent company who ultimately became the shareholders and the acquirer. And so there was a natural feeling of partnership already with the future owners. So it took any of the emotional sting that may have been there. I think it was different. I mean, my pride in the company certainly was in the brand, but I never felt that I could take credit for the brand because it wasn't what me or my family had developed. My pride was in our success in satisfying customers and operating successfully and treating, you know, our people fairly. All of that is able to continue under the new ownership. So that was never going to get lost. That was more something that that's how I like to run a business. So no, I don't think it was. But I could absolutely see for somebody who had been an initial founder, had the initial idea and developed the initial brand, yeah, it could be very difficult to come to that decision.
And how did your employees react to the decision to sell?
It was definitely a bit of a nerve-wracking time. Nobody likes change, and change is difficult. And in this type of a situation, there's a lot of unknowns, right? Because you don't know how things are going to change after the result of the deal. Now, fortunately, again, like me, many of my employees had relationships with their counterparts in Germany, so they knew them. And so where there were friendships, I think that helped. But no, it's never a decision to be taken on lightly because it does affect people and it is not an easy thing to go through.
What about your clients? Were they affected by the transaction?
No. But again, I think that was because we were in a unique situation where many of our clients would not have known that we were owned separately or private company because we always went to market as a global brand. And even though we were privately owned in North America, many of our projects, we still worked with our parent company on, where some components would come from us and some components would come from them. And we worked very closely all the time.
And were there any surprises or lessons coming out of the transaction?
The biggest thing looking back was I wished I hadn't allowed so much nervousness through it. I mean, there was a lot of times where I was worried about certain things going on in the negotiations, and I think I was worrying too much. It really wasn't and didn't need to be a scary thing. You need to be careful and prudent, but if you have faith that you are, you know, being honest with yourself and with your partners across the table, and you feel confident in the advisors that you have, then I think that you needn't worry as much. You just need to be careful.
And if you were to think back on the objectives that you had at the time that you were doing the transaction, how many of the goals that you had or ways that you hoped it would turn out have come to pass?
Well, the initial goal of the transaction was really just to have a successful deal. And I would have gauged that by just saying 4 years or 5 years after the deal, were both sides of it happy? And I think we've achieved that. So I'm satisfied with what the outcome was. And you know, our business has remained profitable and successful. And we have got a very strong relationship with the parent company. So all of that, I think, is very, you know, worked out quite well. Beyond that, I didn't have many goals sort of the day before the signing of the contract. But the day after, when I have a new role now as the, you know, someone, the managing director of a business that has foreign shareholders, well, now it becomes about implementing the new strategies, developing the new businesses, and, you know, governing a good business. And so that's an ongoing set of goals and activities. And it's, you know, that's the reason I go to work every day.
So what's been the most fun part of the journey of running Hazemag for 15 years?
Well, the most fun part for me always is going on customer visits to visit quarries and mines or going underground. You know, seeing our equipment in operation is always a real thrill. And of course, also going to see fab shops. I mean, I'm a mechanical engineer, so going to see machine shops and watching cut the steel and shape the metal. I mean, it's always fun to see that.
And what's next for Hazemag in North America?
Well, after the transaction, or since the transaction, we now have access to a much broader portfolio of products and solutions. And so that's been where I've been spending most of my time, is trying to get those into the market here. And that's been very rewarding. We've had some initial successes already, and we are on the cusp of some pretty big launches, which is going to be very fun for us to grow.
And for you personally, do you feel like it's had a beneficial impact on your life to go from owner to managing director? Less stress?
I don't know if it's less stress. It's different stress. You know, the accountability that you have changes, but you're still accountable. It's certainly satisfied on a conservative side of things. It's nice to lock in the profits from your business. But professionally, now I get an opportunity to you know, grow in new products and new industries that I wouldn't have otherwise had access to. So there's both sides to it.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're just as excited for the future of the company as you were when you were an owner?
Yes. Again, differently. You have different goals when you're an owner. They're closely aligned, but they're slightly different. But now it is about finding the best parts of the group globally and deploying them within my market, my geography. And that is quite rewarding when it's successful. It's very challenging, but we do have some interesting things to offer North America, and I'm excited to be developing those.
It's not uncommon for a business owner that gets acquired to stay on and work for the company that does the acquisition. If someone is considering an offer like that, do you have any advice for them as to how they should think through the transaction and life afterwards?
The most important part is to make sure that during the transaction, you get an opportunity to meet and really get to know the people you're going to work with. I know that sounds obvious and trite, but if you can be comfortable with who you're going to be accountable to and who you're going to rely on to do things for you, then that will make your transition that much better. I was lucky in that the management of the parent company that acquired us did have a mindset to include the leadership of their subsidiaries in their governing body. And so that has given me and others, both in my company and in the other sister companies, a voice in the global direction. So I get a sense to feel like we are all, rowing at the same beat. And that's good. If you don't think you're going to have that, then you should probably structure some form of a time frame with a good exit, because it won't work. But fortunately, the strategic goal of the company that acquired us was in line with what my operational goal was for my company, and so it's worked out.
And was there any complications in the negotiation of the deal, knowing that you were going to be continuing to work for them after the deal closed?
Well, it did mean that the terms of my employment were tied up in the shareholder agreement. And so that did require some additional legal negotiation and some additional legal experts and other advisors. But again, I felt that though our process took a long time, I did feel like we were able to achieve a fair amount of transparency with each other. And that really helped. In fact, if anything, I would say that I was initially surprised by how transparent the acquirer was with me, and because they shared a lot of information with me early on that I was surprised that they would, but that helped. It absolutely helped. And I think it led to a certain openness across the entire transaction.
It certainly signals a spirit of partnership right from the get-go.
Yeah.
Great. Well, if someone is interested in learning more about Hazemag in North America, where should they go to find out more information?
Well, our website is www.hazemag.com, and it has all sorts of information about us.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Stuart. It was my pleasure.
All right. I really enjoyed that conversation with Jeff Hawker about Hazemag. Now we're going to talk to Jeff Clam, a corporate lawyer with Caravel Law, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the considerations that go into preparing your company for an eventual sale. All right. I'm delighted to be joined on the podcast now by Jeff Clam from Caravel Law. Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about your practice?
Thanks, Stuart. I'm delighted to be here. I have a corporate law practice which focuses on corporate transactions. And in that capacity, I act for clients on M&A and financing transactions, both for public and private companies.
That's great. So you're a perfect person to speak to today. We just heard from Jeff Hawker at Hazemag about how he thought through the decision to sell his company back to the parent company in Germany. When a client is considering a sale, there's obviously the emotional side of things, but what other kind of issues should they be thinking through, and what kind of prep work is usually needed?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of prep work that can be done. It sort of varies to some degree how much you must do versus how much you want to do, and it really relates to how quickly you want the transaction to go once it starts. Once transactions start, they sometimes take a life of their own. So the more prepared you can be on the outset, the better off you are. The first consideration in my mind really is thinking financially about the value of the business and how you're going to market it. Sometimes there are obvious purchasers who you have in mind who you could contact on your own. But sometimes an M&A advisor is useful to speak to, as they can help you find leads. The second key piece of advice is tax advice. What will ultimately matter is what you end up with after all taxes are paid. The next sort of key thing you got to do is get your house in order. You will have to expect a very detailed diligence process that literally combs over every part of your business. You should not be surprised if you get a 10 to 12 page or even longer due diligence request list asking to see everything that you have. Some of the specific things to focus on here is your minute book. If it's out of date, that will cause purchasers some concern, and they'll generally ask you to bring it up to date and to rectify it. If it's been several years since you've done that, you might find yourself having a hard time remembering what happened, or you might have to chase signatures from people who are no longer involved with the business. You also need to make sure your employment contracts are sort of all lined up, particularly if it's a tech business. They'll want to know that all intellectual property has been assigned to the business. You need to start thinking about which third-party consents might be required to the transaction. Like if you've got a bank loan or a lease, then those are consents that you almost certainly need. If you have other shareholders in the business, you need to think about them. You need to think about your shareholders' agreement and what rights you have. to sort of bring them along for the transaction. And if you have secured creditors, that's also something that could take a long time to sort of get sorted out. And I think finally, some businesses, this may not be relevant for all, you want to separate personal stuff from your business. You might have a company car that you've used for personal use. You might have family members who are employed in the business. There could be other sort of overlap or commingling between what's personal and what's the business. And so you need to think about that just to make sure that's all tidied up and clean when the purchaser starts thinking about these things.
So there's a lot of work in getting yourself ready. How far in advance should companies start to think about preparing themselves for a sale?
Look, I mean, as far in advance as possible, I think it would be a dangerous strategy to, wake up one morning and hope to conclude a deal within 2 or 3 months. I guess if I sort of had to give a general guideline, I would say 4 to 6 months minimum, but ideally longer. And usually these are sort of decisions that don't come to you overnight. They're decisions that sort of grow. I mean, if a purchaser comes out of nowhere and makes an unsolicited offer, there's nothing you can do other than get prepared at that time. But otherwise, if it's something that you're thinking about and intending to do, then the earlier you prepare, the better off you'll.
Sounds like regular care and maintenance is still a good idea in all cases.
Absolutely, particularly on things like minute book matters and employment contracts and your other material contracts. And of course, financial record keeping, tax filings.
So in Jeff's case, he stayed on to run Hazemag as president. If a owner or a founder is going to stay on board after a sale is completed, what are some of the things they should be thinking about in the way that that gets structured?
Well, the first sort of question is it just a transition services arrangement where you're helping the buyer get their feet under themselves, or are you really going to be a material service provider to them? If it's the latter, then you need to think about whether you're an employee to them or if you are a consultant or contractor to them. There's tax implications in each. One of the key sort of differences that you'll want to think about will trigger off of whether or not you have an earnout clause in your contract. An earnout clause is a clause that entitles the vendor to additional consideration based on business performance in the future. So you would close the deal, you get a base amount of consideration at that time, and then 1 year or 2 years later, however you define it, you might get more consideration depending on how the business has performed. In that case, sellers often want to stay on because they want some control over how the business is run, and that will allow them to help the earnout be achieved. And so that's really something important is what will your title be? What level of control will you have over how the business is operated? And what protection you might have against the business being changed in a manner that prevents the earnout?
Are there any key points that really determine or drive whether an entrepreneur or a business owner is happy at the end of a transaction?
Sure. Obviously, when you're selling your business, you're doing it because you think it's the right time, both in terms of your status in life and also the value of your business. I think another thing that makes sellers very happy once they've sort of really thought through the economics of the deal and the emotional side of the deal is that they don't have a lot hanging over them, which really relates to kind of how long the representations and warranties you give survive, what your indemnity exposure is. You'd like to think that when you sell your business and you receive the proceeds, that you don't have this scepter hanging over you that might come back. Any reasonable purchaser will want some comfort with that, but the more you can manage that, I think the easier it is to sort of carry on and move on something that was probably a very critical and important piece of your life.
That's a lot of really helpful information for everybody. Thank you very much for your time today, Jeff.
My pleasure.
I want to thank my guests on the podcast today, Jeff Hawker from Hazemag and Jeff Clam from Caravel Law. If you'd like more information about Caravel Law, please check us out at caravellaw.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Business Decisions Podcast. Thank you very much for downloading. We'd love it if you would subscribe, leave us a rating, and share this podcast with others that you think might benefit from these conversations. We'll be back next week with episode 5. And until then, we hope all of your business decisions are great ones.